Hi, I'm Leanne Ward.
And I'm Susie Burrell.
And welcome to The Nutrition Couch, a weekly podcast from two of Australia's leading dietitians, bringing you everything that is new in the world of nutrition, diets, and good food. From The Nutrition Couch today, we're chatting about the media trend of volume eating and how it can assist you to lose weight. Our client case study of the week is about gluten-free diets and cross-contamination. And on our most popular segment, the supermarket product of the week, we discuss the Fiber One bars. And in our final segment with our listener question, we're chatting all things condiments and healthy sauces. What are the best options to use when you're trying to lose weight or be healthy?
But before we start today, Leanne, you've announced some pretty big news this week.
I have, Susie, and listeners for The Nutrition Couch, we are expecting a baby. It's been pretty hard to hide, but woohoo, there it is.
So give the full story. How many weeks are you? When's the due date? What do we know so far?
So we're 17 weeks. It is a Christmas baby. I won't reveal the gender just yet because I'm yet to post that on social, Susie, but Bubby Pitt is due on December 22nd. So may or may not be a Christmas baby, may or may not come a little bit earlier or a little bit later. For my sakes, I hope it's a few days earlier that we can have a nice rosé on Christmas Day. I've been doing dry July for multiple months now, Susie.
That's hilarious because I think back now we can share this with our listeners. So probably about 4 or 6 weeks ago, we hopped on our regular weekly chat and I looked at Leanne and I said, you look like crap. But I said, you look tired.
Yeah, I was exhausted.
And then it was just like the next week you told me that you're pregnant. So I had to laugh because I usually am pretty good with people when things change. So I feel like if I had been and actually seen you in Brisbane, I would have been right onto it.
Yeah,
and I have noticed that online your belly has not been showing as often as it has been. But we will keep everyone updated with the bump pics because I am obsessed with those kind of images. I know that I had my twins 5 years ago and I love nothing more than talking babies and pregnancy. But I have to say you've been very, very calm and relaxed. I hope this is a sign of what motherhood has in store for you.
Thank you. Well, very calm and relaxed, but also sort of very quiet on socials. I've been getting messages being like, are you okay? Or I had a big break in my podcast and I don't think I've posted a TikTok video for about 3 months now. I was just the fatigue. Oh my goodness. Like no one tells you about the fatigue in the first couple of months. And for me, it lasted right through to nearly 16 weeks. Like I remember everyone saying, you'll feel so much better by week 12. And I just remember like week 12 going by, week 13, week 14. And I was like, oh man, will this ever end? And I don't think I've ever experienced that. Like it just felt like my brain wouldn't work. And I'm sure all the mums out there know what I mean. But I mean, I've been tired before, like so tired that I needed a point to the nap. But this is just a whole nother level. Like I couldn't think, I couldn't process things. Oh, it was ridiculous. But coming out of that now, I'm feeling a little bit better in week 17, which is nice.
But you haven't been feeling sick, have you? Like you've been feeling, apart from the fatigue, you haven't been feeling unwell.
Yeah, up until about week 9, I did have sort of on and off nausea, never threw up once, which was good. But the way to combat that I did was just constantly eat. So I put on a couple of extra kilos in the first trimester, but I was just constantly snacking on anything that I could get my hands on carb-wise because I felt like when I didn't eat, I felt the nausea was a lot worse. So for me, eating actually helped it, whereas I know for a lot of people, they're the complete opposite. They can't eat a thing. But for me, just the constant snacking and the constant grazing actually really helped the nausea. And then I had this weird metallic taste in my mouth as well. Everything just tasted so off. Everything just tasted so weird. I couldn't even bear the thought of eating protein for the first probably couple of months. So I'm sort of glad that I can actually enjoy my salmon and salad again and actually get enjoyment from those sorts of meals because for a little while there it was kind of like peanut butter on toast. I think I had 2 minute noodles a couple of times because I just wanted that saltiness. I just craved salt and carbs in the first few months. So I'm back to more balanced nutrition and balanced eating these days, which is nice.
Oh, good. I remember when I used to have clinic, I felt very unwell for the first 14 weeks and then the nausea just relieved very quickly. But I remember when I was in clinic with clients, I wouldn't feel sick because I was engaged with them. And then the minute I would finish, I would feel this terrible illness and I would get cheesels, like so disgusting now, a packet of cheesels and I would like suck a cheesel at a time just to try and settle my stomach. So these examples are probably resonating with a lot of our listeners and we're very excited to bring you the journey of Leanne's baby over the next few months. So we'll be sure to post regular updates. But a big congratulations from the Nutrition Couch family. We're so excited and we're so thrilled and we can't wait to share this journey with you. So fantastic news.
Thank you so much. Yeah, excited to finally share it with everybody. It's been nice. So, Susie, how's your week been going so far?
Well, we do record this podcast a little bit in advance, you may have noticed, just to make sure we always have an episode for our listeners every Sunday. So we are now recording and it is lockdown in Sydney. I've had a nice gallivant up to Queensland for 3 weeks. I was very lucky to escape. Mind you, I kept it on the low because I felt so bad that so many of my friends were here with kids in lockdown. So we've had the first morning of homeschooling today. I think the twins have got an attention span of about 5 minutes. I'm not sure if that's normal for five-year-olds. And now I've sent them out with their father to do some nature inquiry. But it's safe to say we're going to be here a good few weeks, I would say, which is also putting off our opportunities to get together and do some planning and have some photos, which is highly inconvenient. But at the moment, we're all just trying to hold tight and get through it. But it does give me a lot of time, Leanne, to brainstorm ideas because people are spending a lot of time at home cooking and shopping. It actually is quite opportune for our industry where people are interested in nutrition and often doing a lot for their health at this time. So pros and cons, really, pros and cons. But yeah, we'll see how we go.
Yeah, and we're thinking of you, Sydney. Stay strong. And I agree. I've got a couple of clients in Sydney at the moment and they're saying it's actually been easier to sort of meal prep and get their grocery list together and stay on track in terms of like regular eating and regular snacking because they've just got more time up their sleeves from not having to do the hour-long commute back and forth to work each day or dropping the kids off. You know, that does take up a significant portion of the day. So if you're listening and you're in lockdown, try to find the silver lining. And if you've got some extra time in your day, use that for a positive benefit, like do a little bit of meal prep, write out a shopping list, do some healthy cooking with the kids, get outside and go for a walk. I mean, there's so many benefits and silver linings to something as negative as a lockdown, isn't there?
100%. And I can't stress that enough that using that time, the extra time we have at home to be physically active and making sure that you're not only getting up regularly from the desk, but you're getting at least 10,000, if not more, steps each day. Not only is it important for psychological health to be outdoors and get some vitamin D, but use that time wisely. And it's interesting to see clients, some of them will absolutely do that and see this as an opportune time to focus on health and well-being. And others will spend it feeling upset and cranky. And really, I really encourage my clients to channel that energy into positive. And I've got a whole lot of online clients at the moment doing really, really well because they have this extra time for meal prep and to really focus on themselves and their health and fitness. So from our perspective, it's not always a bad thing being in lockdown, but we don't want to take away from those who are struggling. So our thoughts are with you.
Definitely. But my biggest tip, Susie, is always to focus on what is in our control. We spend so much time being so upset and angry and annoyed at things that at the end of the day, we have no control around. We can't control if we go into lockdown. We can't control how many cases Australia is having worldwide. What we can control is the good food that we put into our body, how much movement we're getting, the positive things we're focusing on, if we're doing gratitude, if we're doing meditation. So, I mean, mental health isn't really one of those things we can control as such, but there are, you know, daily habits and behaviors that we can do that may help us improve our mental health at the end of the day.
100%. And I had to laugh because the school suggested that we dress the kids in their uniform each day. And I thought, don't be ridiculous. I am more not washing, creating no all that washing. Are you out of your mind? So I look at the glass half full and was thinking, oh, good. I don't have to do the uniforms. I don't have to pack the lunches. I thought it was fantastic. So a lot of it is to do with mindset, 100%.
Yeah. And if your kids are staying in their PJs all day, there is zero judgment from us here.
So true.
All right, Susie, let's chat about what's trending in the media this week. So I came across a really great article on volume eating. And for some people, volume eating might be a newer concept, but as dietitians, it's something that we've been talking about for years. And this article was titled, Experts Explain How Volume Eating Can Help You Lose Weight While Still Feeling Full. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to talk about. It was getting quite a lot of comments. It was gaining a bit of traction in the media. I think it's everybody wants to know, you know, what's the next best thing they can do to lose weight and actually not feel like they're starving. So I guess the concept of volume eating is based on the Ultimate Volumetrics Diet by a nutrition scientist called Barbara Rolls. And it essentially just encourages people to fill up on foods that are what we call high volume, but low in calories. So things like fruits and vegetables and soups and whole grains. And then we're going to try and limit portions of higher density foods. So foods that are high calorie, but low volume. And because these high volume foods contain more water, they contain more fiber, they contain less calories, they help us to stay fuller for longer and also aid with weight loss. So, I mean, it kind of sounds like a foolproof plan for weight loss, doesn't it, Susie? What are your thoughts on volume eating? I personally am a huge fan of volume eating.
Now, Barbara Rolls has been the guru of this area for, I want to say, 30 years. I think she released her first book and it's probably been revised several times since then, because she did a huge number of studies going back many years now, looking at the effect of bulking up food and basically preaching a message of eat more, not less, because traditionally dietitians have been focused on what we shouldn't be eating. So eat less of that and not that and avoid this and cut back on that, which we know from psychological research actually reduces our neural pathways. So we're thinking in a reductionist way as opposed to looking for opportunity. So psychologically, a volumetric approach, which is looking for high nutrient density but low calorie density foods, is a very smart way of priming people to eat more and fill their plate first. And the easiest way I can think of describing it is whenever you're building a meal, you put mostly on the plate things that are low calorie. So for in the case of your morning breakfast, for example, filling it up a lot more with low calorie foods like your berries and whole grain oats and low fat milk, to get a lower calorie load than things that have got a much higher energy density if you were using a lot of things like, say, full cream milk or full fat yogurt or a more processed granola cereal that had a lot more calories or heavier portions of higher calorie fruit. So these simple swaps, but visually it looks really appealing because not only does it look like a volume of food, but they're often fresh, whole, natural whole foods, which are brightly colored and look really good on the plate. And if you look at dietitians' feeds on Instagram, that's what they do. They're generally promoting a volumetrics approach to diet. And so you get to have a lot more so you don't feel deprived. And the biggest thing that my clients say when we go through their diets is they've never eaten so many serves of vegetables each day. And they're full, their digestive system's working well, the plates are brightly colored. And so it's a very positive nutrition message, but also ticking the boxes on all the things, Leanne, that we're wanting to do with our clients, which is about having more fiber and having fewer calories and enjoying your meals and making balanced whole meals. So I don't think you'd find a dietitian out there who isn't a massive fan of volumetrics because it's such a positive message about health and food and nutrition in general.
100%. And I just found it so interesting that the media had picked this up almost like a new diet trend, but it's something that like dietitians have been preaching, eat more damn vegetables for like what, the last 100 years. And it's funny that the media's picked this up and spun this in a way that it's new and it's trendy. So I thought we can jump with this, Susie. Any opportunity we have to promote more vegetables is okay by me. And I guess to give you an example, I actually had a really great volume dense lunch. So we actually had tacos for dinner last night and we bought the taco kit where there were, I think like 8 or 10 shells in it or something. So we ate all the shells for dinner last night and I had leftover mince and beans. I had a ton of leftover salad and a bit of leftover salsa as well. So for lunch today, I just essentially built a taco salad bowl. So I had just this enormous amount of there was so much lettuce and baby spinach left. I had a little bit of tomato, had some cucumber, some grated carrot left. I put my mince and beans in the middle and I covered it with a bit of salsa and a little bit of sour cream that was left over. And that was for my lunch. And I was like, oh, I don't really have any taco shells or corn chips left, but if I want, I can go and get something afterwards, have a bit of fruit or something for my carb serve. But I was so full after that, that I think 2 hours later, I'm still trying to digest my lunch because of all that salad. And it took me about 45 minutes to eat, to chew down all of that salad as well. And that's the other benefit of volume eating, is that I guess it essentially helps with mindfulness without you even really knowing that or recognizing that, I guess, because it takes so long to chew down all of that salad and all of that fiber that you naturally eat so much slower. You naturally pay that little bit more attention to your food. And because you're eating slower, your body takes more time to digest it. You feel fuller for longer. So there's so many benefits from volume eating all around. I really couldn't think of one negative unless you had a specific health condition where your digestion was super, super slow and you actually had to eat really, you know, a lot of small meals, or you had to get things out of your stomach quite quickly. You've had some sort of surgery in your intestines or something like that. But I think for the majority of healthy people, volume eating is something we should all get behind.
And the mince is a perfect example, because if I was cooking mince, if I had 500 grams of extra lean beef mince, and I always do spend on really lean protein, the extra lean chicken mince or even pork that you could all find in extra trim varieties. Now, I just will make a point about that actually, because I got frustrated at Aldi last week because they don't label the fat content of their mince, which I don't think is appropriate. Whereas I find in Woolies and Coles, you can find the extra lean pork, chicken and beef mince. So definitely spend on that. But when I'm cooking 500 grams of mince, I add to it onion, mushroom, grated zucchini, grated carrot, sometimes celery, and often some kidney beans as well. So that 500 grams of mince is not one meal for my family. It's absolutely two and probably three if I'm also incorporating a lunch meal. So that is a very simple way. Whenever you've got any kind of protein or heavier ingredient, just diluting it with vegetables right through it. And if we walk through a day in the life of volume eating, we've spoken about the oats in the morning, but you could also add a vegetable juice in. So maybe a beetroot, celery, carrot juice if you had a juicer. Instantly that increases the overall bulk of food going through your stomach. If we were looking at snacks through the day, rather than just reaching for a protein bar or a nut bar, you would have a couple of cups of cut up celery, cucumber, tomatoes that would go with it. And feel free to chime in at any time with any of your ideas, Leanne. Or if you were making a protein smoothie in the morning, you would bulk it up with some extra, perhaps cucumber through it or spinach leaves or kale. You wouldn't necessarily even notice that they were there. But again, it's giving that bulk and that fiber aspect that's going through your gut and slowing the digestion. At lunch, as you spoke about, the veggies through any of the meals you're having or adding an entire soup to that. And then, of course, for dinner, we want at least the 2 to 3 cups of salad or vegetables, or start with an entree of salad, or end the meal with a little bit of Greek yogurt and loads of berries and passion fruit. And you have literally doubled or even tripled the volume of food that's moving through your digestive system for maybe a couple of hundred calories max for that entire day. And you probably wouldn't even count them if the bulk of those was low calorie salad and vegetables, because the actual process of digestion compared to the calorie content is relatively insignificant.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, no, I think volume eating is something that everybody can get behind.
And I might do a shout out. We don't usually shout out, but I'll shout out to the moving dietitian, Paula Norris, because she does some of the best volumetric eating models and recipes and images on Instagram. So the moving dietitian, I think, is a great person to follow for more ideas. I haven't seen anyone do volumetrics eating better than she does. So shout out to Paula. She's a great dietitian doing some great things down there in Melbourne.
I agree.
And she's also a mum of twins. She's a mum of twins. So hats off to her. So give her a follow if you're interested, because some really great other ideas on top of what we do around how to build volumetrics eating into your own diets. All right. So moving on, this is a topic of huge interest to me because I specialize in weight management. I specialize in hormonal control, a bit of pediatrics. I don't do a lot of food allergy and intolerance, and the girls I work with in Sydney really specialize in this as well, as do you. So I found your case study was so fascinating because you had a client who came through who was a diagnosed celiac, which is very different from being gluten intolerant or have an intolerance to wheat. But you identified that she was experiencing cross-contamination in her diet when she shouldn't have been and didn't realize. Now, I get asked all the time about gluten-free diets, particularly on social media. So this is a great topic I thought to chat about specifically in relation to your case study, and also just talking about gluten-free eating in general, because it's such a huge area and we've had a lot of questions come through on our Instagram, the Nutrition Couch podcast. So give us a follow if you're not already, about this area. So give us some insight into your client specifically and her diagnosis and how you identified that she was getting cross-contamination.
Yeah. So she'd been a long-term celiac, I think from memory, 7, 8, 9 years, like had been diagnosed quite young, had the biopsy. So, proper diagnosis wasn't just something that her GP went, oh, I think you may have a problem with gluten. She had the proper biopsies, came back definite celiac. And to the best of her knowledge, she was being 100% compliant with her gluten-free diet. So she came to me within my coaching service, Susie. I work with women on fat loss, we work on emotional eating, and we work on gut health. So all three of those issues were things that she was having troubles with. And I thought for her, she was having a lot of symptoms from a gut health perspective, a lot of diarrhea, a lot of bloating. She had really, really low iron levels. And that sort of just set the red flag off in my mind. We thought, all right, let's just start with the gut health stuff, get that sorted out. Then we can focus on the fat loss and drill down to some of the psychology behind emotional eating and that sort of thing. So for what I picked up, she had been a long-term celiac. She'd been 100% gluten-free as much as she could or as much as she knew how. She wasn't going and having a pie when she went to the football or, occasionally just have some bread when she felt like it. She was basically 100% compliant and hadn't had gluten in, 7, 8, 9 years. So when she was originally diagnosed, she went and saw a naturopath. So not a dietitian, but a naturopath. So the naturopath explained to her all of these foods contain gluten, but never once went through what cross-contamination was. My client did a lot of social eating. She ate at a lot of cafes. She always checked the menus, only ordered gluten-free options. Would love to get, you know, nothing more than a cake or something like that from a bakery on the weekend. Always the gluten-free option of whatever was available at the cafe. And as much as she was able to, she read food labels, but her understanding about food labeling wasn't great. So there was a few different things going on here. Firstly, she wasn't aware about cross-contamination. So she lived with her boyfriend and they lived with another couple as well in the house. So in the household, they shared things like the butter container, the Vegemite bottle, they shared a toaster. So with cross-contamination, even the smallest amount of gluten, if you put your gluten-free toast into the same toaster that somebody's put their wheat-containing toast into, that can cause a reaction in somebody with celiac disease, whether or not you're symptomatic. And I think this is the hardest part for a lot of diagnosed celiac to understand, because you've got two camps of celiacs. You've got those that are very symptomatic and those that don't really experience symptoms at all. And maybe it was an accidental pickup or a pickup because a family member had celiac disease and they got diagnosed. But because they're not symptomatic, it's very hard for them to understand the damage they're doing at that intestinal level when they don't feel those symptoms. So she felt those symptoms, but they weren't severe. They just came across as more like IBS, bloating, a bit of diarrhea every now and then, and that was it. So I think originally her diagnosis was really picked up due to her super low iron levels when she was quite young. So it was the iron that led to the diagnosis. And in that share house, you know, she was always having her gluten-free products, but she'd put her bread into the same toaster that the wheat-containing bread had gone into. She'd dip her knife in the same container that the butter or the Vegemite. You know, sometimes you look at a jar of jam or a jar of Vegemite and there's crumbs in there because someone's had a double or a triple dip. And it's always like, oh. So I always say, if you have diagnosed celiac disease, you need your own spreads. You need your own toaster. You can't be doing things like that, because whether or not you experience that symptom, you're still getting that cross-contamination and that damage at an intestinal level. Now, the other thing, Susie, was a social eating. So yes, she was choosing foods that were gluten-free from the menu, but the amount of cafes and chefs who do not understand cross-contamination, they need to have a separate work area to prepare the gluten-free pizza. If they're kneading the dough on the exact same table that they needed the wheat-containing dough, you've got issues. You know, she would grab a cake out of the cabinet. And I said to her when we first met, I want you to go down to your favorite cafe. I want you to stand there looking at how they serve their food for 5 or 10 minutes and tell me if they use the same tongs to grab out the gluten-free cakes as they do the normal cakes. And you can bet your bottom dollar they did. So the staff weren't trained in how to minimize cross-contamination. If you're going to have gluten-free cakes in your cafe, you sure as heck better be using different tongs to grab those cakes than the normal, you know, gluten-containing cakes as well. So we're getting a lot of cross-contamination from social eating. We're getting it from the own household. And also with food labeling, as unfortunate as it is, if you have diagnosed celiac disease, you really should not be eating products that say may contain traces of gluten, because we simply don't know if there are traces in that product or not, because most of it comes down to the level of processing at a factory. And I remember Cadbury's just dairy milk chocolate, plain dairy milk chocolate. 5-10 years ago when I started as a gastro dietitian, celiacs could have that. It was fine. And then they changed the factory that Cadbury processes chocolate in, and automatically there was this new warning label saying may contain traces of gluten on the label. And there were broken hearts all around Australia with celiacs saying we can't have dairy milk anymore, not because the ingredients listed wheat in them, but because the factory that it was made on also processed other materials and food products that had gluten in them. So there's a huge level of concern when it comes to cross-contamination, because long term, if you're not 100% compliant with that gluten-free diet, it can lead to cancer. And that's probably one of the worst side effects, but we see it often and often again. And if that does happen, the chances of survival from there, they're not great, Susie. Like it's one of those diagnoses where the only cure for celiac disease is a 100% gluten-free diet, 100% compliance, and minimizing as much cross-contamination as you can get. So I just thought that was interesting for our listeners and for some people out there who may have friends or family that are diagnosed celiacs, whether or not they're symptomatic, the cross-contamination is so important. So if you're hosting a dinner party for a friend that you know has diagnosed celiac disease, please be very careful about your workspaces, how you're cooking and preparing food. When you're reading ingredients, don't just look at it, you know, the ingredients to check that it's gluten-free. You need to look at the may contain traces of statements as well, just to make sure that your loved ones are completely safe, put it that way.
The example that springs to my mind is the oil, because often if you go to pubs or cafes, people think that hot chips or fries or sweet potato fries are gluten-free because, of course, the ingredient. But they'll often, very rarely, if ever, will they have two fryers. So they will be frying the salt and pepper squid and the regular I'm thinking like schnitzel crumbs, things that have got gluten in them, in the exact same oil base as someone who is going for the gluten-free option will have. So just because it says, you know, these are gluten-free items on a menu, you've got to check where they're doing the deep frying, particularly in pubs and cafes. And you're absolutely right. I don't think we speak enough about the association between exposure as a true celiac and increased risk of malignancy in the digestive tract. It's quite pronounced, those statistics about that. And I think because we see a lot of people with food intolerance or people choosing not to have gluten for various reasons, we sometimes get a little bit blasé, and it can't be said clearly enough that if you're a diagnosed celiac, it's literally a severe food allergy and you must avoid it at all costs. And there is a big difference between food intolerance and celiac disease, and we're not taking away from intolerance. We'll cover that on another podcast episode. But if you're a true diagnosed celiac, this is the level of specificity. And it's a good reminder because we don't think about it so often, and we trust that restaurants and cafes, if it says gluten-free, they will have these standards. And unfortunately, it's not regulated as much, because is it 1 in 100,000 people who have celiac disease? Is it 91%? It's increasing. And I think a significant proportion of people still do not know that they have it. And seeing that in Australia, we are seeing an increase in the number of digestive tract cancers, and quite markedly in recent years of younger people, we need to really pay attention to digestive discomfort and those symptoms, be working closely with a dietitian and your GP if you have ongoing gut discomfort and you don't know what the underlying cause is, to make sure that you do have this diagnosis. And I'll give an example of a friend of mine. His sister is a celiac, and the only symptom that he had was headache. So he had been sort of a bit of irritable bowel, but nothing pronounced. And he'd never had a screen, even though his sister had that diagnosis. And eventually when he had the proper testing done, which again can be quite complicated in itself, because if you've been avoiding gluten, you can come back with a false negative. So it is quite an intense testing process to really identify true celiacs. But he really, the only thing that had markedly stood out for him in recent years was he'd had headaches. And, you know, of course he'd been having gluten inadvertently for years and inevitably would have done significant damage to his gut. So it is an area that we will continue to see interest and growth in. And as we said, if you know you are celiac, that's the level of attention that needs to be paid to make sure cross-contamination isn't happening to you.
Yeah, and let us be very clear, if you're somebody that avoids gluten or avoids wheat because it just makes you a bit bloated or it flares up your IBS, you don't need to be avoiding may contain traces of statements. That's absolutely okay for you to have. We're only really talking about diagnosed celiacs here that need to go to that level. Other people, you know, with a bit of an intolerance to wheat or an intolerance to gluten can, you know, have small amounts. It's absolutely okay. Or, you know, I have a lot of clients who have a bit of a wheat intolerance and they'll go out and have a bowl of pasta and, you know, suffer the next day from it, but they're like, well, it was delicious, it was worth it. Unfortunately, if you do have diagnosed celiac, you just cannot do those things. And I remember from working in my time in the gastroenterology clinic, Susie, I had people in tears in front of me begging me to just say, just can I just do this once or can I do this twice? But it's almost like the doctors used to describe it like playing Russian roulette, like just one meal or one, you know, thing off plan. Or we had, you know, clients who would have hot cross buns for 1 or 2 weeks over Easter every year, just because they're like, well, I'm not symptomatic, it's not doing me any harm. And I remember one of those ladies did end up with stomach cancer. And it's one of those things that we don't know until we know. And by the time you know, if you do have some sort of cancer, it's honestly probably too late. So it's one of those things where it sucks and there's no other cure for it, but it's 100% abstinence from gluten if you do have diagnosed celiac disease.
It's a severe food allergy. And so just a question that had come through on our podcast channels, what about if you have the celiac gene but are not celiac? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so you can carry the gene, and a lot of people do carry the gene and will never develop celiac disease. So celiac disease is an autoimmune condition. You cannot have celiac disease without the gene. So if you test negative to the gene, you will not develop celiac disease. But if you carry the gene, something needs to happen. And from the latest research in science, it's really around some sort of environmental or genetic sort of trigger. Something triggers that gene to switch on, and then you develop celiac disease. And from the research, I think it's It's something to do with an upset of gut bacteria. So it could be a period of sickness or a period of stress or some sort of heavy medication use. It's linked to big life changes like going through a relationship breakdown or starting university or traveling overseas or something like that. So they've looked at a lot of researchers in terms of what turns on that gene in a lot of people. But one of the best things you can do if you carry that gene, you do not have to avoid gluten until you've been diagnosed with celiac disease and that gene switches on. So you can absolutely continue to still eat gluten. But the best thing you can do to try and prevent that gene from switching on, for lack of a better word, there's nothing in the research that we know that will prevent that gene from switching on, but one of the best things they think that you can do is have a wide diversity of plants in your diet and really just work to improve your gut health overall, because good gut health, minimizing stress, having a great lifestyle approach is one of the best things that we know of to try and prevent that switch from being turned on. But if you do carry the gene and you've been diagnosed or you don't have celiac disease, you can continue to eat gluten. That's absolutely okay. It's just until you get that diagnosis, not saying that you ever will, but if you do become diagnosed, it's then that you need to avoid gluten completely.
And I think for those people, and I have that gene actually, if paying attention to any change in your gut function is really, really important. And we say that all the time around irritable bowel and a number of indicators for other health conditions. But specifically, if you do know you have that gene, it is really important you pay attention to any change in your digestive comfort, bowel habits, because that can be very telling when it comes to triggering some of this. And in that instance, it could indeed suggest that the gene had been triggered. So pay a lot of attention, and change to your regular routine is very important.
Absolutely. And just a yearly blood test. If you know that you carry the gene or you have family members, you know, direct family members that also or have celiac disease or also carry the gene, it's just something that you want to keep at the back of your mind. And I would just recommend a yearly blood test with your doctor, because sometimes one of the biggest telltale signs of you developing celiac disease is low vitamins and minerals, because your gut, your intestines are inflamed and you're not absorbing nutrients like you should be because of that gut inflammation. So a lot of times I've sent clients for proper testing and biopsies and screening, and they've come back with diagnosed celiac disease. And the only telltale sign we had was super low iron, despite them eating, you know, a ton of red meat, you know, doing all the right things, and their iron was still incredibly low. So I think that just doing a routine blood test with your GP is just going to help you with peace of mind, I think, once a year.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. So interesting. We could talk about it all day.
Absolutely. But we don't have too much longer on this podcast, Susie. So we will move on to our most popular segment of the podcast, which is our new and exciting supermarket products. And this week, Susie, you want to chat about Fiber One bars.
Fiber One bars, yes. And I became familiar with this product. So in the good old days when we could travel, I used to love to go to America, Hawaii, New York, sometimes twice a year. I loved it. And one of the things that I loved was seeing the range of different foods. Now, admittedly, a lot of the US foods are heavily processed. There's a lot of protein bars. There's a lot of snack food. But because of the huge population, there's a huge number of calorie-controlled snack food. And specifically, whenever you go to America, there's a lot of 100-calorie and less snacks. It's a real marketing focus. And one of the products has been available here in Australia for a while. And it turns up in my office. One of the girls that I work with in Bondi, she has a lot of clients who love this product. Now, these, you would have seen them. They're in the snack food section. And there's a whole lot of them, but the specific one we're going to talk about today is the Fiber One 90 calorie bar. And the best way, Leanne, I can describe it is that it's like a kind of dense biscuit with a chocolate drizzle. So this specific flavor is chocolate fudge brownie. There's several different ones. I think there's a birthday cake and there's a caramel one. And they heavily market on the fact that they're less than 90 calories per serve. It's quite small. It's 24 grams. You get about five or six in a packet, a gram of protein, 3 grams of fat per serve, 1.9 saturated, so 8.1 grams percentage saturated fat. So still not as low as we would like at less than 3% saturated fat. 11.4 grams of carbohydrate per serve, 7.2 grams of sugar, so 30% sugar overall, and quite significant in such a small product. It's about 20% or 5.1 grams of dietary fiber per serve. Now, when we take a look at the ingredient list, that's even more interesting. The first ingredient, which would explain the high fiber content, is chicory root extract, followed by wheat flour, icing sugar, vegetable fats and oils, which hasten to say are probably palm oil coming out of the States, sugar, cocoa powder, fructose, wheat fiber. So the ingredient list is relatively long for a snack food product. And if you were looking at a quick quick look at that product, you think, well, it's light, it's low calorie. I don't know. I don't love them. You know, I bought them not long ago and thought, oh, can I include them in my meal plans? And I couldn't eat it. The texture for me was way too sweet. It was kind of a heavy cake. I didn't enjoy it. If my clients like them and ask me about them, I can factor them in because they are relatively low calorie, but it's definitely not one of my go-to snack foods, even though you would absolutely infer it as quite a treat because it's very, very sweet and still retains a portion control, which is why we can sometimes still use them and obviously why my colleagues use them in their own meal plans. But what do you think? Have you tried them before?
Yeah, I'm not a fan, Susie, I must say. I mean, just purely, I work with a lot of gut health clients from an IBS perspective. The number one ingredient is chicory root extract. You're going to have a ton of problems if you're someone with IBS or who gets quite bloated. That's a ridiculous amount of fiber in one tiny little bar. I just counted up, Susie. There's 16, 17 ingredients in this product. It's highly processed. You're right, the vegetable oils are probably palm oil, so they're not great. To me, it's not great. I mean, the top, I think, six ingredients, there's three types of sugars. There's icing sugar, there's fructose, and there's actual sugar as well. And, you know, nearly 30% sugar in a tiny little bar, it's not a great product. I mean, if you love it, by all means, eat it. But, I mean, for 90 calories, yeah, that's cool. But I could eat that in two bites and be like, what next? There's zero satisfaction for me. There's zero satiety. It's not filling. You know, I'd much rather have a piece of fruit or a yogurt or something like that that's, you know, sweet and still quite filling as well. Or just, you know, an apple and a few squares of chocolate to me. Yes, it might be slightly more calories, but to me at the end of the day, it's going to fill me up a lot longer, which is going to prevent me from overeating later on. Whereas something like this, I wouldn't call this a snack. Like, this wouldn't fill 99% of my clients up as a snack choice. It's just got no satiety there. There's no volume.
And it's that texture that really gets me. It really that dissolves in the mouth. You know, it doesn't have any chew factor, which we've spoken about when it comes to the volumetrics eating. We want people to be chewing through their food because that slows down eating. And in the case of a product that's got more protein and it's a slower digestive process. If a client came to me and said they love them, I could include it in that sort of 100 calorie a day little extra if they wanted something sweet. But I'm a little bit like you. I'd actually prefer them to have even a couple of squares of dark chocolate. I think there's better small portion control bars available, which have a little choc drizzle or a choc base. I'm thinking of the little mini Carmen's Bites. There's a caramel one and a cherry choc one that I really quite like. I think they're only about 60 calories as well. So, you know, it's one of those things. If you enjoy them because you seek out that very sweet, more processed food and you like it, and you can control yourself and not eat three out of the box at a time and have one a day, but it would definitely not be something I would go to myself. I think looking at their website, that the product of the Fiber One range that I don't mind is the popcorn bar, but I'll just bring it up now while we're here because to me it looks less kind of processed in the sense it's got some whole grain in it. That comes in at 84 calories. It's only 4.7. It's about 20% sugar, so a little bit lower. So in that product range, I also think there are better options out there than this particular one. But it was interesting to me because, as I said, it's really popular in the States and one of their big, big sellers when it comes to calorie-controlled sweet treats.
Yeah, the States are well known for, you know, calorie control but highly, highly processed snacks. So, yeah, for me, it doesn't even really register on my radar. As you said, if clients love it, sure, I'm happy to work it into, you know, their daily intake, but it's not something I'd be recommending for the majority of people.
And I think we've really moved on a lot just from pure calorie control. It's about nutrient density, which again links back to our volumetrics talk. So, yeah, it's an interesting one because it really still preaches that dietary approach of reminds me of the early 80s when we did the limits and there were these biscuits that you would eat for breakfast because they were calorie controlled. But I think nutrition has really evolved from that. And yeah, it's a little bit of America on our shelves, but definitely I'm like you, it wouldn't be my go-to. But we'll pop it up so you can have a look and you can let us know your thoughts if you've tried it. All right, so for our final segment, we had another great listener question come up online about sauces, and it made me think that often my clients, when I'm writing their meal plans, they will ask me a little bit about sauces. So whether it's tomato sauce with meat or whether it's mayonnaise or pesto or even butter, margarine, olive oil dressings, you know, how do you navigate that space? And I think my position on sauces are if they're consumed in moderation, and when I say moderation, Leanne, I'm talking about I say maybe a 20 cent or 20 gram tablespoon serve to flavor up a healthy meal. So if you've got a massive salad and you use a little bit of mayonnaise, full strength stuff, so it's not as heavily processed as some of the lighter varieties, I have no issue with it because I would rather my clients enjoy their food, have a little bit of added sauce to it, and eat more salad and vegetables. But what I will also say is that if people love sauces, they tend to use a lot. So they won't just use soy sauce in a stir fry. They'll use hoisin plus teriyaki plus soy, and that's doubling it up. So I do usually stress and say one sauce per meal, and you do need to measure it. And that's kind of my position on it. It's not going to add a huge amount of calories as part of a balanced meal, but I'm not talking about the, as I described before, the Jamie Oliver pour of oil, et cetera, through salads. It is watching how much. And I would encourage people to measure because often we have no idea how much we're actually having. And you squirt the tomato sauce over the fish or over the meat and you're having two or three times the amount you actually think you are. So it is worth measuring it out when you're adding it to a plate.
And I think the question is quite interesting from the fact that they asked about condiments and healthy sauces and what the best options were for weight loss and also just to be healthy. The same thing that they're also different. So something can be healthy but not applicable for weight loss, or something can be better for weight loss but not necessarily healthy. So I think that it's kind of difficult to try to separate that or give an answer to both things. But I think with, you know, healthier type sauces, yeah, so, sure. Some of our dressings more based on, you know, olive oil and a bit of lemon juice and a bit of black pepper and some garlic, that can be great sort of dressings. I normally say for clients, look for see-through type things. So if you're going and say, for example, you're at Subway and you're looking for the sauce to put on your sub or with your salad, the ones that aren't see-through, so like the creamier ones, are generally quite high in fat, so a lot higher in calories. So for fat loss, probably to be avoided those, you know, ranch type ones and the, you know, Texan barbecue, that sort of thing. But the see-through ones, such as the sweet onion one, is a little bit better. The low-fat French onion, those sorts of ones are a little bit better. But I agree with you, like if it's to flavor things like a big salad, then I absolutely think that's fine. Add a tablespoon or so of sauce to help you get that veggie in. But if you're flavoring like your, you know, deep fried potato chips, so you're flavoring your sausage roll or something like that, which is already really calorie dense, just be very, very careful with the things that you're adding to that. But one of my favorite sauces or condiments to add to a meal, Susie, is salsa. It's super low calorie. It's basically just like tomatoes, capsicum, onion. It's one of my favorite things to eat with veggie sticks. Add it to a little bit of, you know, like protein or that sort of thing. Even like tofu and salsa goes really well together. And my mum makes this amazing chili jam, which I love having with lean protein, like a bit of tofu or fish or salmon or something as well. So she makes that from scratch and bottles it up for us kids. And it's really, really delicious. So I think anything like that with a base of sort of like tomato base is probably your best bet versus something like a pesto, which can be quite high in fat, or more like a butter or a base like a margarine or something like that, or a mayonnaise, or I think just be a little bit wary with things like that, or quite sugary more dressings like sweet chili sauces and that sort of thing. Don't go too heavy on those ones. I think the clearer see-through ones or the tomato base options are always my best pick if the goal is fat loss and just watching I guess the calories in the meal.
The hell. And the vinegars, things like balsamic vinegar, don't add a huge amount point. With quite a lot of flavor, plain chili sauce over sweet chili. And another tip for families, because I know there's a lot of mums listening who'll be thinking about their kids who'll only eat their food with tomato sauce. I think you've just got to, from an early age, teach them to regulate the portion, even if you give them the teaspoon and get them to measure it out so they learn to self-regulate their amounts and they know how much they can have. And these are good tools for all of us because it's about that ability to regulate what we're having and do it in a controlled way rather than avoid, and then binge. I think the other tip I would have is if you can stay away from the processed dressings in supermarkets, like all of the ranches. And when you look at the ingredient list, they're really heavily processed. There's not much, there's often just vegetable oil, which will be palm oil. So they're not adding much good to the diet whatsoever. So there's definitely better options when it comes to herbs and spices. And one of my favorite things to do is I get like a marinated feta, and because it's already quite wet, when I put it through the salad, you just get a dressing already. You don't have to add another one. When I'm doing stir fries, I usually use a salt reduced soy. I don't double up on all the teriyakis and the hoisins, which can have a lot of extra sugar added. And I usually, as a rule of thumb, as I said, say one addition. So I say feta or avocado or olive oil dressing, not all of them, whereas I find my clients are very quick to double up on several different things. So they'll have a sandwich and they'll put Philly and avocado and cheese as opposed to just choosing one. So I think the one rule when it comes to guiding additives like extra fats goes a long way in keeping the amounts controlled.
And mustard's another really good one. I just thought of that. We probably didn't mention. Yeah, love mustard. Particularly the whole grain. The one is delicious. And Dijon makes for a really, really good dressing that you can dilute up with a little bit of lemon juice and just a tiny little bit of olive oil or something and make up a really beautiful Dijon salad dressing as well.
That is a great one. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, Susie, that brings us to the end of the Nutrition Couch for another week. If you guys haven't done so already, please do not forget to subscribe to us on your podcasting platform. And that way you will get us in your inbox every Sunday morning for a new episode to listen to. And don't forget to follow our social media pages. We're at the Nutrition Couch Podcast. And if you could leave us a positive 5-star review on any of your platforms, but preferably the Purple Apple Podcast app would be the best way to leave us a rating and review, because that's the one that actually influences the charts. And the Nutrition Couch podcast has been sitting at, you know, number 1 to 3 in the charts since we launched. And that's really thanks to you guys, your subscriptions and your ratings and reviews. It really does mean the world to us. And it means that we can continue on with this podcast. So we would love it if you could share it with your family, your friends, anyone that you think would find just the episodes themselves useful, or the entire podcast. If there's someone who loves podcasts, you know, let them know about us so they can have a listen every Sunday and learn the most updated media trends and topics and advice in the nutrition space. So
we were top 5 in health and fitness yesterday. So it was awesome.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, doing really well. Thank you for all the support and feedback, guys. And we will see you same time, same place next Sunday.
See you later.